We are going to reconvene while folks are having lunch, and we're next going to go into the Student Affairs Committee with Regent Henson.
Mark and Lynn, are you all ready? Thank you, Chairman Bell. I appreciate that nice little introduction. You should have kind of gone along and said I was Her Highness, Vice President, Best Order Regent. You forgot Kusalei Opa. I will be geared up on how to introduce me properly in the future. But thank you so much, sir. I get the opportunity to introduce two ladies. They really don't need an introduction from me. It's Dr. Lynn Holland and Dr. Martha Seale. Martha is my sister from a different mother, and I am so excited about this project, and it is called the Intercultural Student Engagement Center Academy, and I first heard about it at a WKU Sisterhood event, our luncheon that was held in the fall, where we grant our distributed grant money, and it just so happened that ISBC actually got some grant money from the Sisterhood, and Martha's got me sold. She then, later we're at a strategic planning meeting together. She wanted to talk to me a little bit. I should have left my checkbook in my car, just so I need it. And she was telling me about some of the projects and about some students in need. So this goes to retention and what they do to retain students. And sometimes that little bit of money, just a little bit of help, makes such a difference. And I started laughing. She just kept wanting to give me this bill. About halfway through, I said, Martha, I'll write you a check. You don't have to keep telling me. And she kept telling me. And I said, you know what? You got me sold. Whenever you need me, let me know. So this made me really, really feel good. I want you to hear about this program. This is very, very positive. Martha and Lynn,
Thank you. So, Regent Henson, thank you for that introduction. And I am super excited to be here. So good afternoon, everyone. There are a couple things that we're going to do today. Primarily talk about the Intercultural Student Engagement Center Academy, which is a byproduct, an initiative of access, student success, recruitment and retention initiative that is rooted in the Intercultural Student Engagement Center. So there's a physical location, ISEC, which is responsible for helping to create the environment on campus, an environment that is diverse, that is equitable, that is inclusive for the entire campus community. But in addition to that setting, that center, there is also an academy that was created exactly 6 months ago. And so our intent today is to provide an overview, a mid-year report on the successes, and I underscore successes, that we are achieving with this program, particularly since it's evidence of a layering of high-impact practices. And I know for some of the new regions, we are using acronyms that may just seem a bit bizarre, but high-impact practices, or HIPs, are multiple things that an institution can do to create an environment for students to be successful, high-touch activities. So ISEC Academy is an example of that. The other thing that we're going to focus on, the things that we've learned and the things that we will eliminate as we move forward, and then some of the things that we are going to set in motion and replicate. So Dr. Sales is the Executive Director of both the Intercultural Student Engagement Center. Her very small team oversees and runs the ISEC Academy, but she is also the executive director of our TRIO programs as well. So, Dr. Sale?
Yes, thank you, Julia. I appreciate you. I'm glad to be here. The reason I think I should highlight with ISEC and TRIO, because a lot of people are not familiar with TRIO as well, TRIO programs are access and success programs. Sponsored by the U.S. Department of Education. We are blessed to have 7 TRIO programs here on campus. They are all housed in Jones Jaggers. And so, as Dr. Holland shared 6 months ago, when we began to look at the strategies of TRIOs and TRIO programs and how they work, we just felt like we should take some of those strategies and place them in the Intercultural Student Engagement Center in order to help and assist our underrepresented minority population who are also first generation and failed elementary. So when we think about the intercultural student engagement center, you want to speak to that, and then I'll talk about.
We want to give you just a quick overview of the purpose of ISET. So that office, as I mentioned before, is about promoting cultural diversity and inclusion, and creating an equitable environment. The office serves as hands-on for recruitment and retention. The center also provides support services to foster academic success and helps our students celebrate when they accomplish the goals that they came here for. We also manage a number of what we call respectful spaces for students to learn about themselves and others. One of those new initiatives has been the ISEC Pride Center for LGBTQIA plus students, and it's located in Downing Student Union on the second floor, right across from the ISEC office. So that's exciting. The tagline for ISEC is where education, students, and culture connect. So this is a place where we're emphasizing education, we're certainly emphasizing students, but we're also emphasizing cultural competency in keeping with the state's initiatives related to diversity, equity, and inclusion and our performance-based funding model. As we mentioned before, the ISEC Academy is a place where scholars are made. So the concept there is that we invite students to come to WKU. And we have an opportunity at that particular moment to begin to perceive them as scholars, to begin to perceive them irrespective of their background, irrespective of their socioeconomic status, irrespective of whether they're first generation or college is something that's part and parcel of their family foundation. It's a place where we can teach them how to be a scholar. We can teach them how to do this thing called college. As I mentioned, it's been in existence for just 6 months. It was a concept as we sat around and talked about the diversity, equity, and inclusion plan for the university. It was an opportunity to set those principles and those guidelines in motion in a real and tangible way. The Academy is organized intentionally in a particular fashion. It is a model of retention that we have successfully borrowed from our TRIO program. There are a number of student success initiatives, high impact practices such as living learning communities, such as blended classes, such as students who reside in the residence hall participating in study sessions within the center itself. It's also an evidence of diversity, equity, and inclusion principles, where our students who participate in ISEC Academy are truly coming from all walks of life. And for many of them, this is the first time that they are engaging with others who are not like them, however that not like them is defined. And as a result, they are learning to become culturally competent as well.
And so a lot of times when people ask me what is ISEC Academy, as Dr. Holland just described, it really is a multiple touch points. It is almost like a quilt. We have taken different strategies that have worked in other programs and sort of kind of woven those strategies together. And our concept is to make sure everybody's covered. We just looked at things that have worked and put them together.
So there are a couple of things that we have focused on. One is in the realm of academics, it's those executive function mastery. We assume that students, and I think I've mentioned this so many times before this board, we assume that students know how to do college, and we have found that that's not the case, so we teach them how to do college. There's also critical things built into the academy for transition and orientation and socialization. What is it that we expect out of them? What are the behaviors that we expect out of them? We expect them to be financial literate. We expect them to learn how to master themselves. And we expect them to become good decision makers and to help them develop a practice of being good decision makers. And of course, the emphasis is also on cultural competency. So the program itself is built on, it's a year-long program. So it's, even though we're targeting first-time students, it's a year-long program. So the students get into campus and participate in a boot camp that is designed to orient them and to help them transition from home to college. We move them into master plan and then immediately begin the ISEC Academy program structure. So there are multiple things that are involved here.
And that is the first year. The second year, it's a year-long program, but also it's really a four-year program. So the first year, we deal with their transition. Second year, we'll deal with their leadership. Third year's career readiness. And then fourth year, everything graduation, everything focused on graduation. A lot of times we spend, as Dr. Holland shared, a whole lot of emphasis on the first year, getting them through from first year to second year. But really, every year is the student's freshman year because they have other issues that they need assistance with their sophomore year, their junior year, their senior year until they graduate and either go to graduate school or obtain a career. So ISEC Academy is designed to be a, we want students to participate all 4 years. It's designed to be a four-year program. Get them out and help them obtain a job and keep it.
Our intent is that no student navigates the college experience at WKU alone, period. That they have a peer mentor or they have a staff member or they have a faculty member that they are connecting with. So in addition to the many programmatic initiatives that we are also involving, the students also engage with navigators. When we moved ISEC into the Downing Student Union, it was interesting. Dr. Sales' office overlooks the Guthrie Tower. And we began thinking about what we wanted this space to look like, what we wanted this experience to be for students. And so one of the things that she said is, you know, we've got that tower there. The tower is a beacon, and the tower is an opportunity. It could be a touch point for students. We could have students meet us at the tower in order for them to become acclimated to the institution. It's something that's visible. But then the other thing that she commented, she said, you know what, we can have our mentors, they can be navigators, using the tower as a point of departure for the rest of their experience here at WKU, but also as a spot that says, I will help you. I will help you navigate. And so those peer mentors are called navigators. And just an aside, there are 24 of some of the sharpest students of color that I have ever had the privilege of working with. And 14 out of those 24 for this semester earned a grade point average of 3 and above. So 14 of them. One of them has a 4.0. Those are the program is not only designed to help those first-time, first-year students, it is also designed to help those seniors and juniors who have become part of the peer mentoring program.
So as the navigators are mentoring the ISEC Academy scholars, faculty and staff, and community people are mentoring the navigators. And so we have layers of a mentorship within ISEC Academy.
There are a number of individuals across campus, a number of units across campus, a number of folk in the community who are invested. Martha is quick to talk about a village. Well, this is beyond a village. This is hundreds of folk who are providing their time and their $10 bills and their talents in order for us to surround these students and to create this environment for them to be successful.
I've been amazed. I've just been amazed with people in the community who will ask me, how can I help? I can't do much, but what can I do? So it could be, again, your time. Sometimes it's just calling to encourage a student. It could be your talent, having people to come back and show different things that they're able to do and assist the student in learning. Something as simple as maybe sewing on a button. Some of these students, they don't know how to do that, those type things. And so it's just life skills. And then also it's just giving up themselves, telling them they can make it. Just being encouragers and mentors. So it's amazing as I go through the community, so many people want to know how they can help.
So let's begin to drill down on some of the numbers here. There were 70 students who were selected to participate in the program. There was an application process, there was an interview, it was multi-layered interview process and the selection process. 69 out of the 70 students were Pell eligible, and 52 out of the 70 were first generation.
Our first goal, however, we were only supposed to, was a target number, and I said 60, but it's very hard for me to tell students no, so we ended up with 70 instead of 60. As she said, we just did interview or talk to the students. We also talked to the parents, because I think they shared earlier, parents are involved in their students' decision not only to attend WKU, but to stay. And so parents, that touch point with parents is very important. I try to, throughout the semester, last semester, talk to as many parents as I could, just a phone call, not just to tell parents what their students weren't doing, but just to tell parents how successful their students were being. And so that was key for parents, because often the parents of these students, they don't get those, they haven't received those positive phone calls. So that's key, and it's also a retention measure within ISET.
So 60 of those 70 students defined themselves as African American, one as Hispanic Latino, and 9 as 2 or more races. Gender identifiers, 47 identified as women, 23 identified as male, and even though it was on the application, there were 0 who identified as other. The interesting thing is that some of these students are not just involved with ISEC, with ISEC Academy, which is rather interesting as well. 23 of the students were Cornerstone students. 3 of them were also concurrently involved with the TRIO program, and then 1 of the students is a member of the Chinese flagship. Now, the reason we have these multiple academic abilities involved in this program is that there's a tiered approach, or in the sense that there are students who selected to be in ISEC Academy for different reasons. So if you would talk a little bit about your coding mechanism.
Some students, of course, the number one factor, they need to be a student of color and or Pell eligible, first generation, and then other. And so we have one student, the student that's the Chinese flagship. She didn't have need any assistance really academically, really didn't have the need for financial, even though she's out of state, but she's from North Carolina, Dr. Pomone, and her mom said, "I want Nala to be around black people." I mean, that was just our statement when she came to our office. She said, because all her life, she hasn't been around that, so she needed to be, she wanted her daughter to be exposed to the social cultural aspect. So sometimes we take for granted, or we think when a student is academically prepared and they're financially ready, that they'll be okay. But there are other factors. There are other factors, especially when it pertains to students of color, that they need in order to feel like they belong here, a sense of belonging, someone they can connect with, someone their parents can call. So that's key too. So as Dr. Holland shared, we're just not looking at the academic and the financial perspective of what the students need, but also that social cultural perspective to keep them here.
23 of our students were considered college ready. 23 were in need of 2 or more developmental courses. 13 had CAI below the admission guidelines for 2018 or 2019. So they would have been below the 65.
But ironically, when I ran the data, 7 of the 13 of the students who probably wouldn't have been admitted with these new standards, actually, several of them were 3 and 0 better, and then most of them were found in good standing.
So those students outperformed some of our other students who had a higher composite admission index. 11 of those students were admitted to the institution either on academic warning or academic
probation.
So, some of the objectives that we wanted to be measurable, as I was talking to Dr. Holland, I said I want us to at least assess what we think worked or will work. And so, as she shared, we have like a mini bridge. Students are able to work. Able to move in the weekend before master plan. And we had a 3-day event the first day when they were able to move in. We provided a sense of belonging for these students. It is a living learning community. Most of the students live in King Hall together and they take 2 or more classes together. So it is a living learning. But we found with a lot of our students of color, they don't feel oftentimes like they belong to them. So I said, what can we do to assure that the students, the minute they arrive on campus, Dr. Miller, what can we do to make them feel like they belong? And so when the navigators, they also got to move in early, they were responsible for assisting the students in moving in. And in King Hall, as soon as a freshman stepped in King Hall, everybody stopped what they were doing and started singing the fight song. I mean, everybody. Just stop. It didn't. You have someone at the door, and they would just make the announcement. Here comes a freshman. So everybody would stop. We would just stand up and sit. And parents were like, you know, what's going on? But by the end of that third day, because we spent 3 days together, those freshmen knew the fight song. And I have a staff person. She actually has 2 degrees from WKU, and she shared, she was our keynote speaker for our scholar luncheon, and she shared that weekend was the first time she had learned the fight song, because I made her, Rachel Ridley. But she said she didn't feel that sense of belonging, so that was key for our students. I know it sounds simple, but it's key. And so the weekend, we had the orientation weekend, they were able to move in. Saturday, they had to get up early, and we took them to the WKU farm. So that was really eye-opening for some of our students from the city. We went to Frankfort, the staff, I will share this, we went to Frankfort a week before, and we leased Tamla 6 white vans, because we don't have budget, so that was the cheapest way to do it. And so we loaded all, anytime during the weekend, we wanted the students to participate, loaded them up in the van, and it was a little high schoolish, some people would say, but we would call roll, who's here, who's not, no man left behind. If somebody wasn't on that van, either I or somebody marched down to Keene, or we blew at Keene before they got on the van. But we took them to the farm, and I remember one student, Justice Ward, was sitting beside me. He said, Dr. Sells, are you going to make me milk a cow? That's a good idea. But they had never been exposed to a farm. And we did some challenge courses and team building. They loved that. And then they also had some body, mind exercises there, brought them back to campus, taught them about Blackboard, TopNet, those key components to be a successful student. And then that Sunday, they were able to dress for success. We had adequate dinner, it was our scholarly lunch. So that was the weekend. And so of that objective, I'm sorry, Dr. Holland, we recruited those students, and 62 of the students that we recruited, I'm sorry, 56 attended. So we had 80% who attended throughout the weekend, that third 3-day weekend. That Friday when they moved in, their parents were able to have a celebration send-off with us. They were able to put pin, Richard Nichols, a big red pin on their son or daughter, and then they sort of kind of gave them to us, and the parents left, and we were able to talk to the students, and then we had an orientation program for the parents. So a lot of the parents had questions about finances, academic, housing, the police department was there, counseling, testing was there. So not only did we orientate the parents, students through this weekend, the parents were orientated as well. Our next objective is that we wanted at least 50% of our students to live, participate in the living learning, living together, taking at least 2 classes, and 31 of our participants did live in Douglas King Hall. So yes, we did meet that objective. Our third objective is they will meet with their, have weekly contact with their ISEC navigator, And this is something we really have to sort of kind of tweak, because students feel like, you know, if I text you, that's the contact. But we really wanted more face-to-face contact, so we'll probably be a little bit more, put a little bit more requirements on that with the navigator, peer mentoring. They did hang out quite a bit. They hung out in our office. They went to ball games together. One night they had a Midnight Madness basketball tournament, navigators against the ISEC Academy. I can't tell you how that went because I was in the bed. I didn't go. But we rented out Preston, or at least Preston, and it was packed. All students came to celebrate with that. Our next objective was that 50% of the participants would complete 6 study hours per week, either in our center or another space. They would swipe in, and 92% of our students had a minimum of six hours per week.
Now, the ISEC space was designed intentionally with not thinking that it would one day be what it is today.
Right.
So the space isn't necessarily conducive to what we have turned it into. So
that's another nice way of saying we've outgrown our space.
But the beauty of it is that the students have owned the space. It's rather fascinating. We have a conference room, which so many of our offices do. We have conference rooms because we work there. We meet there. We hold meetings there. Well, the students have commandeered the conference room. And they have taken ownership of the space, and they have taken ownership of their study, in the sense that they will post a note on the door, and they will say, if you walk through these doors, it's about study. If you want to socialize, you do it out there. And so it isn't something that we have had to do. It's something that they have chosen themselves. And they love the fact that we've trusted them enough to sit in leather chairs. It's the little things that they actually sit in leather chairs, and they sit around a conference table as opposed to sitting in desk. And so they have owned that space. And there are days when we're stepping over bodies. And that is not an exaggeration. There are days that we're stepping over bodies because students are in that space studying. So it's pretty phenomenal.
And the location is unique, too, because we share a kitchen with SGA. And that also gives another exposure to students of color who might not think about being interested or even joining other programs throughout campus. Our next objective, 50% of the ISEC Academy participants will participate in monthly activities. We have academic activities and cultural social activities, at least three we either sponsor or we support. And so Christina, one of my staff members, she sends out texts and let students know what's going on. And 69% of our participants logged into at least one of the monthly sponsored or supported activities. Another objective, we wanted to make sure that students just weren't here, but they maintain satisfactory academic progress, and 64.8% of our participants were in good standing after this first semester. And then our last objective was to look at if students returned from fall to spring. And 74% of our students are back. 12 students are not returning. We have assisted 6 of those students with transitioning somewhere else. Over the break, we called all 70 students and asked them, are you coming back? Why not? Do you have any financial concerns? What are they? Do you have a spring calendar schedule, why or why not? What is it that we can assist you to be successful with? So we, about the third week, because timing is key, when we returned, I think it was like the 34th, we began making calls to our participants. So we talked to all 70 students to see if they were returning. Some students were like, I don't want to come back. Will you assist me? I want to go to JCC. It's closer to home. It's more cost effective. For my family, and so we assisted 6 of those 12 students with transferring. They transferred to either a community college, one went to U of L, and one is attending UK this spring. And then currently, 6 students we have not checked yet into the center, so we are still looking to make sure they are doing okay.
So the last piece is focused on what have we learned and where will we go from here. So it's our refinement. So as we began doing a bit of assessment with our students, they self-reported at one of our touch points. There are touch points periodically throughout the course of the semester. So they reported financial concerns, having outstanding balances for the fall semester. So that would have been November. Some of them reported that they were having difficulty with their roommates, and that because it's a living learning community, so their roommate more than likely was an ISEC participant, it was easy for us to mediate those roommate conflicts quickly. And Housing and Residence Life did an excellent job of assisting us with that. 8 out of those 70 students indicated a mental health concern, and we were able to have them connected to the Counseling and Testing Center and other mental health resources across the campus and in the community as well. And then 40 of the 70 who participated in the self-report assessment indicated positive regard for both ISEC Academy and for WKU, indicating a sense of belonging. So we're going to drill down quickly on some of the things that we've learned here, and it has been quite a bit. So one of the program's objectives was that students would participate in at least 50% of the academy's functions. 17 students opted not to participate at the required level.
And that was 50% or more of the things that we offered. 50%, I'm sorry.
Those students who opted not to participate are also our students who are on academic warning and probation. So we're certainly not ready at this point to make any major inferences. It's just interesting information, just things that we're learning. 23 of the students who were cornerstone students have also been placed on academic warning or probation, which is rather fascinating as well. Student support services data indicated that the overall academic warning probation rate or percentage for the institution is 59%. For ISEC, we have 64.8% who are in good academic standing. So we are exceeding the university percentage at this particular point. That is encouraging.
We already touched on this.
The third one there, our participants require intensive financial, academic, and personal support. Oftentimes, their needs exceed the center's finite resources, the staff's resources. ISEC, again, is this place that is designed to assist all students. The academy is a piece of it. There's this overall mission to assist all students. But oftentimes our academy participants, their needs are so great, we are focusing an inordinate amount of time on meeting their needs, which is an opportunity for us to begin thinking about expansion, scalability, creation of additional resources, because so many of our students our first gen, as we've talked many times today, they're first generation, they're Pell eligible, they have the same needs as our ISEC Academy students. So the model that we have been using and implemented in ISEC for the past 6 months is something that we must figure out a way to expand to the rest of the campus community. Several of the students who did not return, and this has been a theme throughout the day, they indicated the financial burden or the debt prohibited them from returning, irrespective of their fall grade point average. So those 12 students who indicated they were not returning to WKU, it wasn't, for some of them, it was not because they were in academic straits, dire straits. we've thought about a universal block of time for students in the academy to be able to focus on intensive training, intensive teaching them how to master the executive functions of being a student. What we have been able to put together is working well, but we need more. So to be able to structure their schedule in such a way that in the middle of the day, there's time for us to meet with them, mentor them, talk with them, conduct programmatic initiatives, a common lecture, a common exhibit at the Fine Arts Center, but just something where we are able to have them come together and we don't have these hodgepodge of schedules. We would also like to focus on more intentionality in the student's schedule. We found several students that things that we did, we created barriers to their success. Here's an example. We would have a student who was placed in an 059 math class, which is a developmental course.
055.
I'm sorry, 055. But then also placed in a microeconomics course. And so what we have done in our zealousness to create a schedule for the student, we've created a schedule that is almost impossible for them to be successful.
Or we'd have a student who would be in an 055, a developmental math, and it would be on a Monday night and a Wednesday night from 5 to 8.
And so a first-year student, first-gen, first-time, first-year, freshman student who is also Pell eligible, first generation to have them in a night class that is very self-directed is challenging, and that was one of the things that we did. So what are some of the things that we're going to discard? So we're going to discard some of our programming initiatives and refer. If the institution, if the student success units across campus are focusing on things, and there's no need for us to replicate that. So we are committing and will examine options for programming so that the programming is not being done in the center, it's being done someplace else, but focusing on those executive functions. Mastery of self, mastery of self-efficacy, those things. We're going to examine discarding a rolling participation deadline.
I just have to learn to say no. Yeah, but we're you know, once we recruit students for the cohort, we really don't need to add any other students.
The team at ISEC, those who work with the academy, are committed to student success. However, one of the things that we must discard in that space is that we're solely responsible for student success. That truly, this is something that the entire campus community needs to be involved with and is involved with in some instances. These are some things that we'll replicate or implement. Prudently seek mechanism to scale the academy concept to other parts of the campus community. Looking for ongoing funding processes. We are so grateful to those individuals in the city, alumni, across the nation, who have fallen in love with this program and are committing their time and their financial resources in this program. However, we're going to need to expand that. Continuing the assessment and the adapting process, that piece is critical too. We're not stagnant here. We have to be nimble and a measure of fluidity there. Judiciously seek involvement and additional partnerships with the campus community alumni and the Bowling Green community. We need more competencies relative to those executive function area, particularly teaching students the things that good students do in order to be successful, studying, outlining chapters, writing notes, taking notes, rewriting notes, repetition, things that so many of us learned either the hard way or we learned them. But being able to teach those things on the front end. And then long-term institutionalization by incorporating ISEC Academy into the university's strategic plan.
Bring this full circle, that it moves out of the pilot stage and that it moves into institutionalization in some form.
Questions?
Okay, I have two questions. So the first is, I noticed that of all 70 students, there's only one Hispanic student. And I know that was not due to recruitment, that was just due to application. There were so fewer Hispanic and Latino students that applied. So is there anything, I guess, being done to partner with OLAS or do additional recruitment outreach within Warren County for a lot of Hispanic students? I was going to bring this up with Dr. Lux's presentation, but then we're running out of time. And one of the things that we talked about was, at least with Fabian Alvarez and some of the people that are part of like that working group for strategic planning, was going to do recruitment with Hispanic students from like freshman through junior year, just because at that point a lot of students don't think that they're college eligible, or they just write it off and like try to go directly into the workforce. And I think that ISEC Academy is really like a great way. So what are your plans for recruitment?
Actually, he was one of our living learning professors.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so he also works with our TRIO program. Mm-hmm. We will be a little bit more targeted in our recruiting this year, because we will go into our high schools and begin to recruit for ISEC Academy.
Okay.
This year, last year we recruited just solely really through word of mouth and through TOPS.
Okay.
But this year we'll be a little bit more targeted. We'll do outreach. Actually, we have 10 students already enrolled in ISEC Academy for cohort 18.
Okay.
Either word of mouth, siblings, parents, Head for the Hill. We've done presentations at Head for the Hill, and students have signed up. But, yes, he's assisting us with that population.
And if I could just follow up real quick, because this is something that's fascinating as well. If you look at, in the last couple of months, really, there have been a number of articles that have appeared in the Chronicle of Higher Ed. And they have focused on the need for students to see someone who looks like them in the classroom or in a particular setting. So keeping that in mind, for our Latino Hispanic student population, we have developed a partnership with our Latino faculty and staff, and we have asked them to come into the center. And so by coming into ISEC, the physical space,
right,
our Latino Hispanic students are following.
That's awesome.
And will give us an opportunity to provide the same resources to that student population that we are currently providing to our ISEC Academies.
And then we're also inviting them to assist us in being part of the Live and Learn, so students are exposed to them outside the classroom and inside the classroom.
And then my final question, so you referenced that students within ISEC Academy needed a lot of individualized attention. Do you think in some way this detracted from other students' needs being met? Because you referenced that they were so time intensive, and like, I don't know, because the only thing, I know this is not the right phrasing because it sounds too severe, but like a second class citizenry, like if other students were not having those needs met?
I really didn't see that, because okay, other students that came in that didn't need as much help,
uh-huh,
we've learned how to replicate ourselves.
Okay.
So students may be able to help a student where if our staff members are really dealing with a specific student, other students would, upperclassmen, not just navigators, would help those students.
Okay.
We hear a lot of conversations on, you know, what outside of our offices and other students help.
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, ladies. We appreciate the presentation. I know George and CJ are supporters of ISEC as well, so we'll notice that a little bit later. Thank you, Ms. Miller.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. I'm done.
All right. Okay. We will move into the executive committee meeting. All members are present, which include myself, Gail, Brady, Julie, and John Ridley. We have three action items listed, and we'll deal with those separately. And the first one involves approval of naming of some designated rooms. We have that. Have a motion and a second to approve the naming of the designated rooms. Any discussion?
Thank you, Jordan.
I was going to say, I think it's worth another. We'll run on it next month and give you a chance to abstain from that vote. We are honored. That is a tremendous gift to the university. So, motion's on the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. Action item number two is a resolution of appreciation in honor of Dr. Barbara Birch. A motion.
So moved.
Second.
Motion and a second to approve the resolution and appreciation of Dr. Birch. Any discussion? We will see if we can have her at our meeting. I hope she will be able to attend next month. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. And the third item is a contract addendum for our head basketball coach.
Mr. Chairman, may I have a point of order on the first two action items, approval of designating names? Just a moment. We need to be sure that there are procedures and policies that are in these individual names went through the process, but to put the name of anyone on any building or facility has to go through a certain process. And so we just need to all be aware that that is, if someone has a suggestion or if one does show up, it needs to go through the process and doesn't automatically just appear on a building somewhere. And I know that that needs to be scrubbed. Because of the different departments, everyone has some ownership in their own buildings, and also, but that also needs to be coordinated with development and so forth. So these obviously are great examples of those that did go through the process, but we do need to be quite conscious of that, especially in brand new buildings.
Your remarks are noted, and I'll again call your attention to action item number three. Do I hear a motion?
So moved.
I hear a second.
Second.
A motion and a second to approve action item number three, which concerns a contract addendum with Coach Stansberry, head basketball coach. We have with us here the head athletic director, and I would like to ask Todd to come before us and tell us anything more about it.
Thank you, Chairman Bale. I would appreciate your time, and I would sum it up like this. I think what I'd like to do is just tell you where we were with respect to men's basketball when we hired Rick Stansberry, where we are now, and where I feel we need to go. When we hired him in March of 2016, it was an incredibly challenging time for our program from a roster standpoint. We literally had 7 players, only 5 were healthy. Only 3 played the season before, and we had 0 scholarship guards. That's where our roster was. Probably one of the most challenging, if not the most challenging, roster situation in the country. We were also not in good shape academically. There's an academic measurement called APR, which stands for Academic Progress Rate. And in order to be eligible for postseason play, you have to average a 940 in APR. Now, that's over a 4-year period, so it's not based on 1 year, it's over a 4-year rolling average. But you have to average a 940 in APR. The year before we hired Rick, our APR was an 880. So that's not good, to put it mildly. And then the third standpoint is the community had really checked out on our basketball program 2 years ago. Our average attendance the season before we hired Rick was the lowest it had been since 1999. So he inherited roster challenges, he inherited academic challenges, and he inherited a dispirited basketball community, so to speak. Fast forward to where we are now, 22 months later, in the on-court team, we're tied for first in Conference USA. We have a win this year over Purdue, who's a number 3 ranked team in the nation. And we have a top 50 RPI, which is really excellent. There's 355 Division I teams. Our RPI today is 44. So that's where we are in terms of on the court. Academically, I mentioned that the season before he was hired, our APR was an 880. Last year, the first full season under Rick Stansberry, it improved to a 979. And you have what the most recent 4 years are on that sheet. And then from a community standpoint, we will have a sellout again tomorrow night. It marks the first time since 2002 that we've had back-to-back sold out games against conference teams. So I think the community is galvanized, and the students. We had 1,600 students at our game against Middle Tennessee last Saturday. So in the 10 years I've been here, I've not seen a crowd like we had last Saturday across the board, from the general fans to the students also. So that's where we are. He's done all that. His base salary during this was $500,000, which was sixth in Conference USA. So really far below even the peer group we have in Conference USA. So I feel like that's something that we need to address. Certainly very aware of our challenges that we have here on campus moving forward. And obviously anything that we would do would have to come from private sources. But we've arranged for that. And through our Hilltopper Athletic Foundation, they voted unanimously yesterday to approve $150,000 annual increase to Rick's base salary, which would move him from sixth in Conference USA to second. I'd like to do it now because I think it means a lot more and will mean a lot more to him to be proactive and simply recognize what he's done so far than wait after the season and be reactive. I just think it carries a lot more weight right now, and I think he's earned it for the reasons that I've laid out. So what I would like is to ask your permission for our Hilltopper Athletic Foundation to transfer $150,000 annually to his base salary. Certainly we'd be happy to take any questions that anybody might have.
I think you should mention the other change to his agreement, which is significant in our favor.
Yes, we would increase his base salary. He's agreed to increase his buyout. So if he were to leave for another head coaching position, right now that school would have to pay us $750,000. He's agreed to up that to $1 million. So we're increasing his base salary by $150,000, but he's increasing his buyout by $250,000. Yes.
So this is paid entirely by outside funding through the Hilltopper Athletic Foundation. It wouldn't result in any increased fees or rooms for students. Okay.
No, it's not through our budget in athletics, not through the university budget, no increased student fees. No increase in ticket prices. It's purely through outside funds.
Before we open it up to full discussion, and I want you to stick around for any questions anyone has, but you have someone here from the Athletic Foundation that I think is prepared to give a presentation.
Yes, so happy to introduce Craig Browning, who's the regional president of U.S. Bank, but is also on our Hilltopper Athletic Foundation executive board. Certainly can speak on behalf of HAF on this matter.
Mr. Chair, distinguished regents, Mr. President, thank you for allowing me to visit with you today, and thank you for lunch. Yes, on behalf of the volunteer Hilltopper Athletic Foundation Board, I also serve on the executive committee, and I'm a past president of the HAF. Our current president, Dr. Burt, is actually out with some patient obligations today, so he asked me to come to say a few words and be available if there's any questions. But on behalf of our 2,225 members, we certainly support the recommendation that Athletic Director Todd Stewart's presented to you today. I won't mention everything that he's already talked about because all of the points he made are very valid and we support those. There's no question that there's excitement around the program. There's no question. Subjectively, there are things that we can point to, but objectively, we can look at attendance. We can look at wins. We can look at exposure on a national stage, and all of those things are very clear facts. We do believe that a strong athletic program is a great window for the university. There's great value in the branding, certainly. And our football program has enjoyed a lot of success in recent years. But many people that you'll talk to over the last few decades would tell you that Western's a basketball school. And we certainly have not enjoyed that level of success to say that we're a basketball school in recent years. But we really believe and we feel that what Coach Stansberry's done in such a short period of time absolutely warrants us being proactive. Because if we're not, then someone else will be placed in a reactive position, as Todd mentioned earlier. And that's not where we want to be at the end of the year. Rick is a Kentucky native. He wants to be here. That's not to say that there won't be something else to lure him away at some point in time. You can't just, tie someone down when they don't know what is ahead of them in life. But based on what he has communicated, not just to the staff and the administration, but also to the fan base, we have no choice but to take him at his word. And this is a place he wants to be, and he's going to take a lot of pride in returning WKU basketball success to its glory days. So we're absolutely supportive, and we're committed. We had a unanimous vote of our board last evening, and we're committed to the $150,000 for this contract term. And the board will certainly, at any time in the future, be glad to sit down and consider any other thoughts or options that need to surface.
Okay. Throw the floor open for discussion, comments, questions.
I commend for thinking the proactiveness of your challenge. Speaks well for your leadership.
A question and a comment. If he stays, and for one certain amount that he does stay, he's done a remarkable job, and I'll echo Freddie. You've done a great job in working this out. The monies for this year, will there be additional private money funding for next year to continue that raise? Or?
Yes, we have a commitment to do that annually for as long as he's the head coach.
And I do want to commend you, and of course I have to, well, back to the staff. These lengthy presentations we've had that were very informative about these great things that that the staff are doing at WKU right now, and I have to point that out. You're absolutely correct in if you don't pay people, they will leave. As I talked with Dr. Caboni, yesterday, and for some of the newer people who are unaware, in 2016 we had a 32% turnover rate among staff. The staff and the faculty as well are every bit as deserving of raises like this. And this raise alone is, we've got staff members that don't make a quarter of what the raise alone is. Different markets understand that. We can't lose focus that overall the staff and the faculty are doing such outstanding jobs themselves. Unfortunately, we don't have corporate sponsors coming in giving those kinds of things. It would be nice if the distinguished professors could get those kinds of things, but we need to make sure we keep a focus on looking at the salaries of our faculty and our staff who are doing such a good job. And again, it's very fitting that it comes at the end of these presentations because it's the staff that are doing the marketing and the recruiting and the things that they're doing for this university to get the students here. And there's such a critical role in the success of this university and everything that we do. Thank you, Todd, for doing a good job and being able to do what I wish we could do for all staff.
Good. Any other comments, questions?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Regent Smith, Dr. Smith, I certainly appreciate everything that you're saying. And I just want to be sure that we truly understand that when it comes time to talk about staff, faculty, administrative salaries, and that being within a restrained budget, that we not confuse that with the philanthropic interest of an individual who would want to donate to some specific cause. And my reference is that if you have a philanthropic interest that wants to endow a professorship, and we say to an individual, well, we really don't need that in the department, please, this is only an example because I'm familiar with this particular one, and a professorship in engineering, but we need it in the health services and sciences area, that philanthropic person is not going to say, well, thank you very much, but I'm going to go to a school that wants it in engineering because that's where my interests lie. And so mixing up the differences of what some philanthropic interest is with a salary increase for a faculty member that's outside of the designated area, we just want to be cautious about that because that can work bad on both sides. And in this particular instance, the Hilltopper Athletic Foundation has a specific mission. It's not about the sciences, it's not about the arts, it's about the athletic. And so those 12 to 15 professorships that we have been given by people who are interested in academics, that needs to be increased and not used as a comparison with what we're doing today, because there are individuals who understand exactly where their dollars are going, and we cannot convince them to put it in a different area. And if we do, then it'll, of course, take away from our philanthropic interests in the future. So, with that said, I support this entirely, just as if I would support accepting a gift for someone in engineering to endow a professorship of $2 million. So, with that said, thank you for your leadership.
Julie?
As an HAF member, as alumni, and as Board of Regents, I say, woo! Great job, Doc.
Mr. President,
I want to echo both what Tamla said and what John said. It's important that we have the ability to raise money for specific purposes. I also think and agree that it's important for us to be able to reward performance and retain talent. That's what we're doing today, and that's what we're going to do in the future for everyone across this institution.
All right. If there's no further comments or questions, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. Todd, maintain your position and we'll go into our athletic mid-year report.
Thank you. Can I use a 20-second timeout and grab our volleyball players who are here?
We'd love to see them. Try something a little different rather than just hear you or have you hear from me as you typically do. I've got three of our shining stars up here, and what I would just quickly point out before I turn it to them, you have this document here that shows our conference championships, really everybody's, since we entered Conference USA. And when we entered Conference USA about 3.5 years ago, we were the last one in. You know, the 14-member conference, we were the last one in. So all eyes were on us. So internally, we realized we really kind of took upon the mantra of you only have one chance to make a first impression. And you know what I would say in looking at that document is what a first impression we made and have continued to make. We've won 23 conference championships since we've been at Conference USA. The next closest school has won 11, so we've doubled up everybody. The single biggest reason why we have 23 and the next closest school has 11 is because of our volleyball program. In the 4 years that we've been in Conference USA, our volleyball program has literally owned Conference USA. We won the regular season championship all 4 years. We won the conference tournament championship all 4 years. Went to the NCAA tournament all 4 years. These three right here, they've just been incredible. I'll start in the middle. Sidney Engel, and you'll hear from each of them here in a second, but Sidney Engel was a three-time all-conference performer, and her sister Rachel actually played here for 4 years. Graduated 2 years ago, so we've had six straight years of Engels in the program. Next year, it'll be Engel withdrawal, unfortunately. Closest to me is Jessica Lucas, who was the last 3 years named the Setter of the Year in the conference, and she won a total in her career of 18 Setter of the Week honors. That's more Player of the Week honors than any Conference USA volleyball player has won in the history of the league. And on the far side here, wounded right now, but not for long, is Alyssa Cavanaugh, who was named the Conference USA Player of the Year the last 2 years, and this year was named a third-team All-American. It's the first time, and we have an illustrious volleyball program, it's the first time in the Western Kentucky volleyball program's history we've had somebody named first, second, or third-team All-American. So that's what they've done on the court. They're actually even more impressive off the court. And what I just wanted to do was turn it over to them and just let them maybe share with you their experiences here as a Western Kentucky student.
I'll go first. So I wrote a little bit something about kind of how I chose Western and the process of that. So it seems like only a short time ago I made the visit here to the volleyball program. I was narrowing down schools that I would consider attending. There are many things to consider when choosing a place to play, but all the people I respect the most gave me the same advice. Choose a school you would be happy at, even if you didn't get to play the sport you love. At the time, I wasn't sure how I would know if the school was right for me. People would say, you'll know when you find the right place, and there will be a level of peace that will come over you, and you'll just know it's the right fit. I later found out that they were right. Upon arriving on campus, I fell in love with this school. The 3-hour trip home after my visit was the only time I needed to realize that Western was the place for me. Throughout my career, these girls here with me and myself have had a lot of success on and off the court, and we owe a lot of that success to the people around here who have helped us get to where we are now in life. Volleyball brought me to this campus, but after being here the past 4 years, I can honestly say that I would come back even if I wasn't playing the sport. Western has been a place where I have been able to grow into the person I am today. My parents are both educators, and they told me there is education that leads to ACE, and there's education that leads to a successful life. And I believe that Western has prepared me for that successful life. As far as this campus, it's beautiful. The professors, staff, and people in general are so professional and friendly. My coaches are awesome and care about me on and off the court. My athletic director cares about each sport and has done everything to provide me with the best opportunities over the past 4 years. People always ask me, if you had to redo it, would you do it again? My answer is always the same, absolutely. This place is now considered my home and hopefully will be for the next 3 years as I continue my career path in physical therapy.
Well, your eyesight must be exceptionally good, too.
This is why you have sleep, Dr. Bale.
Yeah, you're wearing glasses that are not
I'm very blind.
Tell us where you're from.
I'm from Seymour, Indiana.
Yeah. I'm from southern Indiana, so it's like 2 hours away from here, right across the bridge from Louisville, Kentucky. But like he mentioned, I have like a legacy here with volleyball and stuff, but like I don't know if he knows this, but my cousins, both of my older cousins also played here. So Travis has coached someone in my family for over a decade at this point, and so I can kind of attest to his character and his dedication to the volleyball program that he really does care about us and that he's stuck around for that long. And just on top of that, like being a student here, I'm in the Gordon Ford College of Business and I'm getting ready to graduate in May. And I think that volleyball has given me a lot of opportunities and I've gotten a lot of memories and relationships through that, but also through the Gordon Ford College of Business, I've also gotten friendships and relationships with teachers that I will definitely cherish for time to come throughout that. And I also plan on going back here because I just can't get enough of it. I'm going to get my MBA when I leave here, and that's about it. I want to go into compliance and hopefully help athletes have the same experience that I had as a student athlete.
I'm Melissa Cavanaugh from Louisville, Kentucky. And going off her, I'd say the biggest thing that I've come out of these 4 years is the relationships. Through volleyball, you like get to meet so many people, like around the donors, professors, all the fans. You get, it's just like amazes me how we aspire little kids. Like I never thought of that I would be so high up on these little kids. Because I was a little kid once, and I looked up to all these people, and now I'm in those shoes, and it's just amazing. But I actually am leaving Western. If they had professional volleyball here, I would stay here and play here. But unfortunately, they don't, so I will be going overseas and be playing professional volleyball for hopefully a couple years once this gets under control. But I know that I'm going to be coming back here as many times as possible to come meet these two. These two are one of my best friends, and I just can't say enough about this program, the volleyball program in this school. And I would never change anything that I've done in the last 4 years. I've grown and matured and done everything possible through this program in this school. So,
thank each of you for being here. And Todd, thank you for bringing them here. And George, back to the book principles. The goal, this the author of that book says, your goal in life should be to have meaningful work and meaningful relationships. Everything else will take care of itself if you seek those two things. So it sounds like you all have certainly had meaningful careers and here and made meaningful relationships. So continue that the rest of your life, and we'll be reading more about you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
To top that. Robin, I'm sorry.
You know, it never does seem to work in my favor, does it? So I get to come and talk to you about legislative relief.
Be a little taller.
Do you want
to be a little taller?
That's right.
Would it help if I had my arm in a sling? Would that make you all feel a little better about this today? Are a little more sorry for me. Well, thank you for the time. I know you've had a long day. I probably don't have anything significantly new to report to you that you don't already know, because we've been communicating with you since the session started, but certainly since the governor proposed his budget. Just to kind of reiterate again what's in that budget proposal, and then I'll kind of let you know what we've done since communicating with you about that last week. So he presented the budget, as you know, on January the 16th. It included a 6.25% budget reduction for state agencies, including universities. For us, that's $4.7 million budget cut from our state appropriation. It's 4.6 and some change, so I rounded up there. It also includes the elimination of funding or reduction of funding of some 70 programs within state government. Many of those are from higher education institutions. We have one that's associated with us, and that is the Mezzanet program. I'm happy to talk about that in a moment if you would like. The budget proposal included to eliminate funding for Mezzanet, which is $750,000, and that's currently appropriated directly for Mezzanet. Other programs that would be eliminated in those 70, teacher scholarship program, work study program, Cole County scholarship programs. I have not added it all up because we are still kind of trying to get information together from various units across campus. But I mean, it would have a substantial impact of probably another $500,000 or so. Again, I haven't added all the moon head. I believe the number Gene shared with me from the Owensboro campus was 13 Cole County scholarship recipients, for example. So they're not things that affect, I mean, they affect the university, but who they really affect are students. So they affect students' abilities to come to college. So those are just a number of things. UK, UofL, and K-State all did presentations before the post-secondary subcommittee on appropriations yesterday, and outlined a lot about the programs that would be eliminated or reduced and how those would impact their institutions and across the state. There is a $300 million bond pool for asset preservation that the governor included. This was part of the CPE budget request. It was higher than that, but $300 million was what funded. The caveat there for the institutions is that in the first year, they fund it half in the first year, half in the second year. In the first year, we would have to match dollar for dollar, 50%. In the second year, we would have to match 60%. I think it's safe to say at this point that we haven't yet determined how we might be able to take advantage of all of that. So I know you all are asking some questions earlier. The language in the budget bill simply states that those projects that CPE has previously identified. So I don't know what that means. Richard Ridley, I know you were asking some questions about that earlier. We don't know what that looks like yet. One thing we do know is that they indicated to us prior to the budget being proposed in the briefing that they had not really prescribed how that would work for universities, what projects would apply, and how we would fund them. So we're going to have to work through those details with the legislature, so that's all going to happen through the session. And that's really the only discussion that we've had about that at this point. We did go up and have a good day in Frankfurt this week, which was not your first visit, President Cavani, to Frankfurt, but it was the first visit while they were in session. Our visit for the governor's budget proposal got snowed out, so... anyway, he had the whole day to himself, really, in some ways. So he was recognized on the floor of the House and Senate, got a wonderful reception from House members and Senate members, and that was a great opportunity to be introduced, I think. But we also had some very substantial meetings. We met with a number of members of House leadership and some also on the Senate side, and again, just kind of took the message of what these budget questions mean to us, not just this year, but in the context of a decade of budget reductions, as well as what we are working through as a campus community. And so I think those were all very well received. I can't say that we got a lot of preview of what they plan to do, because they don't know yet. In addition to the budget, which really that is the biggest thing, I think you all know that typically we sort of come forward with the legislative priority sheet, you know, usually have a little piece of paper and we have a number of things listed. We did not do that this year, which is a little bit of a difference, but it's just because the situation is different. We knew the CPE budget request was really our primary priority. The budget is our primary priority. We don't have any other legislation that we are specifically seeking this year. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But we are we are monitoring a number of pieces of legislation. A big bill on KEYS dropped yesterday. The KEYS funding that high school students get, that will have some substantial differences. We're trying to work through that, understand what all that means, and working with our folks on campus to do that. So we've probably got about 75 bills right now that we have distributed across campus to various folks to read and review. Not a lot of movement of those things yet. They expect the budget to come out of the House a week earlier, so probably about the end of February. And then the Senate will have it in March, and session ends in April. So that's where we are today. Okay. Gosh, I thought I was going to get away with that. Mr. Ridley.
I have two questions. The first question is that it's follow up on earlier, you know, this idea that a 50-50 match on, so I think if we had more clarification as quickly as possible of whether that was infrastructure or ongoing projects, but if it is what has already been approved by CPE, you know, we've got a lot of businesses out there, and I'm talking about business and philanthropic interests that have an interest in WKU, and if they knew that they could get a dollar for dollar on a philanthropic gift for a new business college or whatever, it seems to me that with only $300 million, you better be ready and have your powder pretty ready to fire.
Well, absolutely.
And so I think that clarification is going to be extremely important for this university. So I would suggest that we look at that. And then the other part of that is there any rumblings in Frankfurt that you're aware of addressing the real issue that's not slash and burn to our budget, but when are they going to address the revenue issue? That there is not enough revenue to support
whether
it's tax reform or, I mean, there's not any discussion, so what do you hear?
Well, what I am hearing is within the next week to 10 days, they probably will roll out a pension bill, and I really didn't mention pension. Pension is driver that is straining all of it. I mean, it's straining our budget, it's straining the state budget. So they'll roll out a pension bill. I don't sense that there's no indication that tax reform is going to be handled in this session. I've heard some mention of a special session. I think the governor maybe talked about having a special session at some point, but I don't know that they feel like they're going to do tax reform in this session. I see nothing right now that says that points to that. Pension bill, we did have some substantive conversation about what pension is doing to our budget. And, I mean, again, it's parallel to what's happening with the state budget. The caution to us was don't expect any savings in the short term, that there wouldn't be any savings that we could accrue from any pension reform in what we're dealing with in the next two-year budget. So that's really the only thing we've been told. But I've heard it would be substantially different from what we saw, what they rolled out earlier. But who knows? That's all speculation and based on just things we heard from folks we talked with. We'll see the pension bill in about 10 days.
Well, as massive as this pension hole really is, if it is what it's being touted to be, this budget cut this year and for the next biennium is a continuous issue for the next 10 or 15 or 20 years. So the impact that we as a university should be, at least in my opinion, we've got to understand that we're going to be under this for the next 20 years. This isn't just how do we get through this year.
No, that's right.
And so it's a revenue issue.
That's right. And that's what they're dealing with from the General Assembly perspective and the governor as well. I mean, they're dealing with how do we take a problem that's taken 40 years to get here and fix it, not just for now, but for the long term. And so really our conversations with legislators this week were about, you know, we understand the challenges. We get that. But what we need from you, our ask, is stability and predictability so that we are not every 2 years coming back with a 30 or 40 or 20 or whatever percent increase. I mean, this time it's a doubling almost of what our pension contribution is. I mean, we can't continue down that road. So I think that our message is the right message, but we won't know anything until we see what they're going to do, what the next pension bill looks like.
Is there a chance?
We should file soon.
Is there a chance the pension bill could help us reduce the 83.5%? Or is that
83.5%? All indications in every conversation that I've had is no. That what we see in the bill right now, it's 83%. It would likely not change, and if it did, it wouldn't be substantial. I mean, we were cautioned by both the chief of staff and the governor's office and also by legislators not to anticipate any substantial savings from any pension bill.
Is there a coordinated effort with your counterparts and with your counterparts to go at the legislators? I assume there is, but we had differences. We probably had differences of positions, but we also have central positions that we.
So sure, you know, we meet regularly, the residents meet regularly. Is there a campaign mounting?
Right. Lobbying effort or whatever.
But we, you know, we're advocates, we're legislative liaisons. Our job is to be there to advocate on behalf of our institutions. We are, you know, and we're working together, obviously, on legislation and on strategy and on sharing information. What's happening right now, and happened, it started yesterday, the week before, CPE was invited to speak to the budget subcommittee on post-secondary education. This week, it was, as I mentioned a moment ago, UK, U of L, and Kentucky State. We will be on the calendar next week, so next Thursday, and then the Thursday after that, they'll have the remaining institutions. So in a period of 4 weeks, they intend to hear from everyone. That's our opportunity to, you know, lay out the challenge. They, you know, I think we were told no dog and pony show. Come to us with the information. We want to know what the impact is. And, I mean, that's where we are at the moment.
Do you want to make a comment on that?
I'll just add that the president's been talking about what the likely effect of this would be. And we're at a place where the most effective effort is going to be one-on-one through each one of our local delegations, and we're going to push on that. The storming the tower with torches is rarely effective, and you catch more flies with honey than vinegar, and so we're going to spread out a lot of honey.
A couple of questions. And our follow-up to Gail's question, is there unification? Are all the institutions going to be on the same page of the hymnal at the end?
So this is where I think we are. I think that because there are so many programs that are targeted, that each institution has a particular interest in those individual programs. For us, that's $750,000, as opposed to the $4.6 million from the other reduction. I think the political danger of focusing on the individual programs is you don't talk about the larger effect. At the same time, if there's a change in the programmatic list, that has an effect on the overall percentage reduction, I think. And so trying to articulate what the effect of the programs are on our individual institutions, at the same time, with a focus on affordability, what the effects are, the compounding effects are on institutions is where we're going to go. And I've watched at least the coverage of University of Kentucky, University of Louisville, and Kentucky State, to a T, they've all been exactly what the presidents have discussed. So to date, the short answer is yes, we are all on the same page and singing from the same song sheet. As the session progresses, keeping all those cats herded winds up being more challenging.
Follow-up question. I know you don't do crystal ball stuff.
I do.
Is there any significant possibility that it could get worse for higher education in cuts?
So let me answer your question this way, Regent Picton. That would not be my experience.
answer.
But there's always possibility.
I will add, this is the state is a longer-term structural issue with the budget. In many ways, there are some similarities with which we're dealing here at WKU. And so for a long-term fix for what has been a trend, we have to have a budget that matches the revenue that we bring in, or we need revenue to match the budget that we have. And it's either one or the other, and I don't think we get to it early in the session, but at some point, that's going to be the conversation. It's going to be the conversation for the Commonwealth, but it's also for the conversation that we work through this semester.
Next question. Is CPE starting any discussions on tuition at this point?
I might have to defer the CPE tuition question. I'm looking back there at Ann. The work group has been involved.
You know, the CPE has work group. They've got a timeline. They don't try to be too public about that while the General Assembly is in session. So they have focused mostly on data right now. So no discussion on preliminary rates. We had a scenario where the governor led us to believe that it could be a whole lot worse than a 6.25% reduction. And in that context, there were some informal discussions about what should the answer be in terms of tuition rate increases with the worst case scenario. That doesn't seem like it will be necessary. So the course is that by April, the CPE will be able to tell us what they call a maximum parameters for how much tuition can go up for a resident undergraduate student next fall.
All right. And that brings us to the end result, and that is that if we are not going to fund our higher education at the state level, then the parents and the students are going to have to pay more. And that's what we got to tell our politicians, is that when you cut the universities doing a great job, then you're increasing the cost on those that are least able to pay it, and that is the individual student.
Andy, I'm going to let you have the last word.
Okay. I had a question regarding the bill on keys, because I've not heard much about this. Like, I've been following
along. Just came out yesterday. Late. I mean, I've just seen it today.
Okay. And would it significantly reduce students' keys funding?
Or? I don't think so. I've quickly read through the bill. I'd be happy to share it with you.
Thank you so much.
It looks like what it is designed to do is allow students to use to access KEYS money while they're in high school for dual credit. And it will eventually, the work ready scholarships will sunset, and the KEYS bill, which is what they that's what they're currently using to fund the dual credit. Three dual credit courses that students can currently take in high school. That happened in the last budget. They would sunset that out, and this would eventually kind of replace that. Is what it looks like to me.
Okay.
But I'll share the bill with you.
Thank you.
It just is going to allow students to access KEYS money in high school, and as they use it though, it will dilute what they can use when they get out of high school.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Rob. We're glad you're up there representing us with Dr. Cabellman.
Thanks.
One last report, John Paul. I'm sorry to have to ask anyone to go after all that we've heard, but if you'll give us a brief update on development and philanthropy.
I would be glad to. Let me assure the board, as I assure the chairman, that I wouldn't risk in my presentation, but please pause and ask any questions that you would like.
Can you stay right there on that first page?
Yes.
For you all that don't know, yes. I was named, because I told everybody about one of them at the end, and I'm not on the board, I'm also a Distinguished Service Medal recipient as of last fall. Thank you. I will not give my 15-minute, place and fame, 15 minutes of fame speech like I did, but I still think you're going to laugh about
it. Your 15-minute, 3-minute address?
Yes, exactly. But it was kind of funny. God, it was kind of funny.
15 seconds.
I can still gator better than Dr. Phil.
There are some other pictures on this. As you all are surveying, but obviously they're very mild. I will just bring your attention to the Alumni Engagement Index feature of our Alumni Association, because we are among the nation leaders in the nation in this conversation. Our governing our professional organization, not governing our professional organization, the Council for Advancement and Support of Education, is looking at a structure to measure alumni engagement, and we've already done that, and it's going to be very similar to what the national model will be. Schools like Cornell and others are looking at how they're engaging their alumni through events, through their private support, through volunteerism. And last year, we tracked that over 17% of our alumni were engaged in one of those categories. Obviously, we have a lot of room for improvement, but we are tracking our alumni engagement index, and we're pleased about that. Other alumni strategies I'll speak to just briefly. Jace has covered our alumni ambassador program and how we assist with recruiting and student referrals. I also know the alumni grant program is something that we market, and it is a program for out-of-state students, prospective students, who parents or parent is an alum. It allows them to have a discounted rate, and that's something that we assist them with to promote. Athletically, you know, there are various ways that we partner with Todd and the athletic program through email and phone campaigns for ticket sales, obviously events. You know, you saw the volleyball team, Topper Tailgate, Conference USA tournament is coming up this spring. Topper's on tour through the summer. The chairman asked me to also share a little bit about the contract that you all have just approved for our basketball coach, and to just talk a little bit about the lift that athletics gives to fundraising and also the university. And I'll do that briefly, but we'll just say that certainly you know, there are a lot of good examples of universities like Butler, like Boise State, most recently Clemson, where you're seeing that lift. Clemson, for example, in the last 6 years, correlating with their football success, their fundraising has essentially doubled. Their enrollment has gone from 18,000 to 22,000. Out-of-state admissions have increased significantly. Obviously, at WKU, we talked about the 150,000 that folks have already committed, and committed to continue that on an ongoing basis. But I would say that it raises the bar in fundraising in general for our institution, and I've seen that. You know, as I've traveled the last 21 years I've been here across the country, I can tell you that people not only want to talk about their favorite professors, but they want to talk about, you know, what's going on athletically. It's something that keeps them in touch. It inspires, it motivates, and it moves the needle here like it does those other places that I've just mentioned. So it's important. And then lastly, on the alumni front, we've partnered with the Society of Lifelong Learning, and we began an evening with series. Our first two events were very successful. We kicked off Homecoming Week. Chief Justice Menton did a nice presentation. And then Dr. Cheever, who is head of the new medical campus here in Bowling Green, also had a great turnout for his event. And then we are partnering with them on a last lecture series where we will work with them and retiring faculty members to be able to present. And I wanted to note that Provost Lee will be giving his here later this spring, and you'll get more detail about that.
I hope his health is good.
Yeah. I think he's got it in.
Best I know.
National Philanthropy Day, we celebrated this year like never before.
In addition to naming our philanthropist of the year, Laura Turner Dugas, we also announced a very impactful gift from CJ and George Nichols that day.
All right.
And we have heard some about that, about ISEC today. In conjunction with the next full board meeting, we will have a ceremony that you will all be invited to attend as well as we celebrate.
John Paul, can I just add, if you've not heard CJ speak, you have missed a real treat.
Don't miss it.
He did a wonderful job.
I totally agree.
And CJ speaking when George is not there is really good too.
Yes.
We will never create that environment again.
And then we have also changed our name. We announced it that day to Philanthropy and Alumni Engagement. And I've already addressed the board and we've spoken about that. And we continue to be excited and affirm that we've made the right decision. Here are some select gift announcements. The first half of the year. Looking at those photos on the left, you'll see some more familiar faces. Regent Ridley and Carolyn. We announced their gift this summer for the Toppers on the Square program.
Good job.
CJ and George, we've spoken about. And then the Mansfields, Bob and Sandy. Bob surprised his wife Sandy one day. They live in Atlanta. They came to campus. He said, "Hey, let's go up to Dill Park." They sat on the bench where she saw her name was on the bench. He had made a gift in her honor, and he also invited the cheerleading squad. She was a former cheerleader here. And he also invited one of her former fellow squad members, Pete Meheran. I don't know if everyone knew that Pete was once a cheerleader here, but he cheered with Sandy. And it was a fantastic moment. And then there are several other gifts that have certainly impacted our campus. I'm pleased with the diversity of support that we continue to get, you know, athletically, academically, and otherwise. You all have at your place, these numbers might be hard to see, but I just want to say that we've had a tremendous first half. We're 89% ahead of where we were this time last year through December. Our record in a 12-month period is $23 million in outright gifts. And through December, as you can see, we're well over $20 million. So we're tracking clearly for a record year of giving here at WKU. And as you look down through this report, you can see that we're up in virtually every category. This gives you a six-year comparison for you all to look. So if you want to look at this you know, post-meeting, if you have any questions or concerns, I'd be glad to talk with you all about this in more detail. But I wanted to give you the entire report just so you can see how we measure our success. On the second page of these numbers, I think it's worth noting that in Section 5, Faculty and Staff Giving, the last 3 years, at least through mid-year, you know, we're tracking ahead of the year before, not only in the number of faculty and staff donors, but also in their total giving. So that's encouraging. The commitment that our faculty and staff have to the institution is indeed inspiring. I don't know if there are any questions. There are a lot of numbers up there. I'll continue to move on unless you all have a question. But it gives you an idea of the different metrics that we utilize to assure that we're successful in supporting our university.
I noticed in Section 2 on their chart there that giving by source, the alumni giving is up doubled in 1 year. But I know the year before it's almost the exact same statistic. I mean, a double. But, I mean, when you go from what can you contribute anything to that large sum or those one-time gifts that made that number go up or three or five or whatever? I mean, that's a pretty significant jump with no campaign going on.
Right. Alumni giving has been going up for us. It's in part due to some mega gifts. I mean, we've had some substantial gifts that have spiked our numbers. We've been very fortunate to have been engaged in those conversations with people to invest in later. People are giving more. Our concern, our challenge is the number of alumni donors is going down. So that's something that the president is engaged with us, and we're looking at different strategies. And it's not just us. It's a nationwide trend that fewer are giving more. So does that answer your question?
Well, and to expand on that, the corporation and foundation, so the corporation giving was up almost twice, and also there's a huge difference, if I'm reading these lines right, from $977,000 to almost $6.5 million for foundations. Yeah. So is there specifics there?
Yes. Mr. Gatton has made a substantial gift through his foundation,
right?
Which has elevated that number.
Yeah. And then the last question is what about the impact of the current tax legislation that apparently has not been exactly defined? How's that look, and how does that fit into your plan for 18 and all?
You know, there's a lot of hyperbole, projections. We're obviously attuned. I think it's a fact that a lot less people will be itemizing their deductions, and their cost to give, if you will go up, because they will not receive that charitable deduction and not use it. So that remains to be seen. You know, the projections are close to 5% decrease they expect in giving. Could be higher for higher education, because there are some categories, religion being one, that they don't expect will drop as much. We are looking at it. We did year end. We did a few more appeals and encouraged people to double up on their giving with the existing tax laws as a strategy. And one other thing we're doing is we're focusing on the other reasons that people give. Fortunately, tax is a reason why people give. It's an incentive, but it's not at the top of the list. So we're focusing on those other out-of-the-list items to try and overcome what we might potentially use. But I will say this. When I show you all numbers in the future, it will be affected pretty substantially by athletic giving. Gifts that are tied to athletic seating are no longer charitable. So
that was going to be my last follow-up question. What impact does that have on that?
Because it's going to be over $2 million at WKU that will come off of our books. And I can give you all the data if you'd like it. I'd like to see more specifics about it. But any gifts that have been made, that have been charitable for the Harbaugh Club, for Bill Arena Luxury Suites, just for all of our seats in general through the Hilltopper Athletic Foundation, those are no longer charitable.
I understand, but there seems to be a creative way that you could take the same amount of giving to the university and reward those givers fashion, whether it be because of the money. It's my understanding. Right. FHA scholarship for those type of programs or ticket sales go toward scholarships.
That's right.
It appears to me then, if administratively we would tie the gift to a scholarship to a benefit.
Right. It just has to be walled off from any
I understand. But I mean, there seems to be some creative way that we can.
Right.
I mean, when it's $2 million, mm-hmm. I believe that'd be,
right.
Turning over every opportunity.
So we're studying it. One thing that we're for sure going to do is we're going to give non-charitable soft credit for people toward the President Circle membership, for example. There are a lot of people that they want to be a member of the President Circle, $1,000 a year, $250 of that is HAF related, $750 they give across the university enterprise. So we'll give them credit. That will count toward their President Circle giving as one incentive. But we're looking at it. The IRS is looking at it too, and there's going to have to be a clear divide as creative as we can be. So
I don't want to step over the line. I'm just saying need to keep the $2 million in the coffers.
Right.
Creative way.
And we will. There will still be the same seat requirement the same dollar amount, it just, you just will not be able to deduct that on your taxes any longer. So, and it won't, so we'll still get the revenue, but it just won't show up on our charitable reports.
Thank you.
Okay. And then in addition to cash, I just know, new pledges, first half of the fiscal year, new deferred gifts that we have documented, and then the current portfolio of proposals that are pending. There are some 107 proposals that are pending. 37 of those are in the form of verbal commitments that we're working to document. And then we've certainly been spending a lot of time transitioning our chief executive, and we've been utilizing the president in many ways, and he's been very gracious. It's certainly a priority for him to engage with alumni, with our top philanthropists. And through June, at present, we have 24 events that are on the docket that he will attend around the country, including next week. We have three in Florida that he will be a part of. And through the first 6 months, he had 118 one-on-one visits with our top donors and donor prospects.
Okay.
Any questions?
Anyone have any questions?
Good report. Thank you.
Very good. All right. That brings us forward to the end.
Chair, I'm going to move that the board go into a closed session as provided in KRA 61-810-7.1 for the purpose of discussing proposed pending litigation against or on behalf of the University of Hong Kong. That would be the executive committee for whoever you instruct to be here.
Second. Have a motion and a second to go into closed session as described. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Want all the board regents to stay if they can. We'll take a 3 minute break.
3 minutes. 3 minutes.
Jeff, get that
turned
on before you break the
floor. Okay. Are we good, Jeff?
Yeah.
Okay. The board has now returned to open session. The discussions and deliberations during the closed session were restricted to those stated in the motion, and no formal action was taken in closed session. We have a number of other informational items, primarily relating to dates of coming things for all of us to get on our calendars. I want to remind everyone who possibly can, we want to attend the AGB National Conference in San Francisco in late April and be making arrangements to do that for anybody who can. The sooner the better. We are also continuing to make efforts to get Tom Sugar to campus, the gentleman we heard at the governor's conference who has lots of wisdom with regards to graduation rates and retention and all the other things that we've talked about at length.
Dr. Bailey, the date of the AGB conference on trusteeship, that is something that each of us pay for to attend as a regent. This is not any
correct
WKU money. This is on our own.
Correct.
To verify that. This is, I think that's appropriate for us to clarify that this is something we're paying for on our own to attend.
Correct. Yes, thank you for bringing that up. And, we do not want anyone thinking we're going to San Francisco for a lark.
That's right. Exactly.
We're going out there to learn, and I think it'll be a very valuable session and give those of us who can attend a great opportunity to talk and have a better vision for higher education. I want to apologize for the length of the meeting, and I think we can make some adjustments on some of the presentations. It occurs to me that if myself in particular and any of the others of us that have been touting small teaching, flipped classroom learning, none of us need to be in here reading something on a screen. We can get those things beforehand, and the time of this board is best spent, as much of today was, being able to speak and share ideas and share opinions. And we will move quickly toward making sure future meetings do not have lengthy presentations. I think our two new regents are going to contribute greatly to us, and I thank both of you all for being here today, and I hope we can all be here at every meeting. I know that's not going to be possible, but both of you certainly bring needed experience and perspectives, and you're great additions to the board. I'm going to close since Regent Henson was so kind to send all of us a little Christmas gift. I'm going to let her read just the top quote from Socrates. And with that...
The secret of change is to focus all of your energy not on fighting the old, but building, but on building the new. Socrates.
Very good.
I just kind of thought that described our strategic
plan. And because this is a committee meeting, I understand I don't think we need a motion. I'm going to call.
You can.